Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we have Antonia Fraser in conversation with William Waldegrave, talking about the drama of the Great Reform Bill.
Right, well, good morning and welcome. And we apologise for being stuck in the lane, the beautiful lane, looking down on the tent where you all were and we weren't. I am an imposter. I know nothing really about the second Reform Bill or the first Reform Bill, about which Antonia knows a very great deal. But we have done a double act before on a different subject, so we thought we'd try it again this time. We are both of us representatives of families that voted against the Reform Bill. In the House of Lords debate on the 13th of April 1832, there we were, the Earl of Longford and the Earl Waldegrave. But we didn't turn up for the final vote when only 20 voted against right at the end. Then it was down to the really hardcore people like Lord Dartmouth and Lord... who else did we have? Willoughby Dearsby, I think.
Yeah.
All members of UKIP now, for some reason. Antonia, how much starting at the beginning of the story is you really perhaps have to go back a year or two to the settlement after the defeat of Napoleon, when the conservative regimes were reinstated across Europe, with, of course, the Duke of Wellington as a great player in that drama. How much do you think that that settlement after the defeat of Napoleon, with the reintroduction of the Bourbons, the Russians influential, the Austrians influential, must have seemed to people of progressive views in the 1820s like going back into the Dark Age?
Well, I think there's a parallel with the end of the 1945 war, actually, which I, in fact, remember. Curiously enough, I was at Godolphin School, which is sponsoring this lecture, which is a curious historical note. But after 1945, people sort of weren't quite sure where they were. Were they going forward, the new Labour government, National Health Service, education, or were they faced with sort of terrible communist revolutionary times all over Europe? And I think great wars, like the Napoleonic Wars, which were so long, do leave a great sense of perturbation in the country. There were tremendous economic distress in England, where, of course, the soldiers came back, as happens always after a war, and there were no jobs. Agricultural distress, the machines were coming, and the machines were taking jobs. So the reaction of a man whose job goes is to bash the machine, and you get agricultural riots under a mythical figure called Captain Swing. So I think you get a state of tremendous perturbation, while at the top, during the government, there's a feeling we must hold steady, everything must remain exactly as it always was. Who won the war anyway? And the answer is, who won the war was the Duke of Wellington, who in 1830 was the Prime Minister, the great man, one of the greatest men that England or Ireland, one should correctly say, has produced. So I think you get an extraordinary, a whirlpool of a time with lots of people saying, hold steady, and we won't be like the continent where they're having another nasty revolution. In 1830, there was another French Revolution, and the Bourbon king was chucked off the throne in favor of a cousin. But we in England, as long as we hold steady, nothing like that will happen to us. Do you agree, William? I think...
Yes, I do. And I think, of course, it's a very crucial point that in 1830, when the new king comes to the throne, and under the law of the time, you have a general election, the Duke of Wellington is the Prime Minister. And that election, which takes place during the summer of 1830, in the usual way, taking some time over a number of months, at the beginning of that election, the issues are all about abolition of slavery and retrenchment, as is always the case, cutting government spending. But by the end of the, because elections took several weeks and months in those days, by the end of it, in the course of it, the French Revolution, Charles X in France is deposed, having summoned back his ambassador from London, Polignac, to be his minister, who dissolves the constitution and bans the free press, things that all politicians like to think about doing. And so by the end of our election, reform and what is happening in France, suddenly it sweeps away all the other issues.
Yes, I think that's quite true. It's one of those flukes of hereditary monarchy. You don't know, first of all, you don't know when the monarch, George IV, is going to die. And then you don't know what the character of the new monarch will be like. And William IV, the new monarch, ascended at the end of June 1830, was the third son. And as the third son, he'd been brought up in the navy. He fought Trafalgar, and he was a bluff naval type, and he was really an unknown quantity. And this again led to a feeling we are in a new era, and a tremendous lot of people, the Whigs, said a new era, and now at last we're going to have reform, by which we mean parliamentary reform. And the Whigs, except for a short period in 1806, had been out of office since living memory. Lord Byron, in one of his naughty rhymes, said, "Naught's permanent about the human race except the Whigs not getting into place." And, of course, the Whigs saw their chance, and with a mixture of, I think, genuine idealism and politics, which is ambition, you know, they decide this is the time to go for it. And so it's a very fascinating scene in the autumn of 1830. And William, can I just explain in simple terms the electoral system? I can't explain it in complicated terms because it was so incredibly complicated. But in short, the system by which there were so many MPs for so many areas and towns was in effect medieval. It had been altered very little in the 18th century. So I'll just give you an example, which I think is rather close home. The following great industrial cities had no votes, no MPs. I repeat, no MPs. Birmingham, Leeds, Sheffield, Manchester. I mean, it's extraordinary. People, when I've announced that, people have said, "You're wrong." But actually, oddly enough, I may be wrong about some things, but I'm not wrong about that. And at the same time, Old Sarum, that agreeable place. How far is Old Sarum from here? I was trying to work it out. Yeah.
6 miles.
Sent two MPs to Parliament. It was a mound, you know, as mounds do. It sent MPs to Parliament. Dunwich, which had fallen into the sea, sent two MPs to Parliament. That's just to show you how this system had got completely out of kilter. Nevertheless, there were people like the Duke of Wellington who said, "It's the perfect constitution. We are the perfect country, and it's the perfect constitution."
So that when that election, when the reassembled parliament arrived back, now with King William as the king, not all your neighbours were or speakers were as reactionary as our families. I don't know whether Lord Congleton is in the audience. There he is. Now, my friend John Vincent, the historian, has a saying, which is just about true, that before the Reform Bill, no general election was ever lost, because you could always fix it pretty well if you were the government in power, or you could renegotiate back in afterwards. But this, and this was, of course, just before the Reform Bill passed, thanks to Sir Henry Parnell, his ancestor, who moved a motion on the civil list, not on reform, actually, I think, but against the government, which was taken as a confidence motion. Wellington's government fell because they met Parliament and tried to form a government. And so Wellington was driven out of power, and in comes your hero, our hero, Lord Grey. Give us a bit of a sketch of Lord Grey's background and what he was like.
Lord Grey was a great gentleman. He was now in his early 60s. But he'd had what you might call a rackety youth or a wonderful youth. As a young man, he was the lover of Georgiana, Duchess of Devonshire, the great Whig lady, and in fact she had an illegitimate child by him, but that was all gone long ago, and he was now extremely happily married, Great Northern Estates, which is what where he wanted to be. And throughout all this crisis, he's writing all the time, if only I could be with my Mary in the north. He had a very loving family who called him by his, well, not actually his Christian name, his nickname, Carr. And it was symbolic somehow. He was a very friendly father. He had all his daughters educated equally with his sons. He had been tremendously handsome. To me, he was handsome still, although, as you will see, the wonderful curls of his youth have given place to a noble pate. But since we're talking about Longfords, my father had a noble pate. I'm very prejudiced in favour of noble pates. I think they betoken high-mindedness and all good qualities. Anyway, as you will find, I hope, if you read the book, Lord Grey, there isn't only one hero, but if there is one, it's Lord Grey. So much so that my friends wickedly said that the book should be called One Shade of Grey. I deny it.
Well, he's an attractive figure, Grey, by any imagination. But now, do not think that these Whigs who came into power were particularly men of the people. There were 14 members of the cabinet, 4 of them were in the House of Commons, and of those, 2, Lord Althorp, and who would have been the other one, were both, Palmerston,
yes,
who held an Irish peerage, were members of the peerage or inheritors of great estates. So they weren't exactly, they were much richer than the Tories, and they were in a way, they were the great 18th century families, weren't they?
Yes, they were the richest cabinet ever known. Forget it, the present cabinet, you know. You sometimes read, curiously enough, in hostile papers that they're very rich. But when you think of this cabinet, they were much richer. And the point about it is that having these great estates, they still felt that it was noblesse oblige. We must do something for our country. This is how they brought up, how their fathers had been, and how they hoped their sons would be. And it is that mixture of idealism and ambition, as I said, which makes politics in itself so interesting. I don't think anyone, I mean, William will contradict me, anybody's ever gone into politics out of pure idealism. There's got to be a bit of salt and pepper of ambition, right?
I think so, yes, probably, yeah.
Yes, to keep you going. So here are the Whigs. Lord Althorp's a particularly interesting character, known as Honest Jack. He was the eldest son of Lord Spencer and would become, in the course of time, Lord Spencer. But the eldest son, with a title, most confusingly, could sit as an MP until he became a real peer. That's a nightmare for somebody who's writing narrative history like me, because you wonder how many times you must explain Lord Althorp's in the House of Commons, you know. And Lord Palmerston was an Irish peer, but he's in the House of Commons. And you begin to curse the rules of the British peerage. Nevertheless, it's not for me to reform them.
Well, at least he didn't call himself Mr. Althorp, as you had somebody around here, I think, who called himself Mr. Carr, or Mr. Anyway, something of that occasion, and really should have been Lothian, but there we are. Now, let's look at some of the arguments. The key thing that had happened just before in Parliament was the emancipation of the Catholics, which had been done by the Wellington Peel government, which had just lost power. But with the great Duke grinding his teeth, really, doing what he was told by Peel and others was his duty, but it left a deep scar on him, I think. And I think he thought, never again am I going to do some parliamentary fandango because I'm told it's the progressive thing to do. So the Duke, faced now in opposition, makes what is, to a politician, a really serious mistake. He goes absolutely four square and says there will be no reform at all. As Antonio said, he says the Constitution is perfect. I cannot see what is to save the church or property or colonies or union with Ireland or eventually the monarchy if the reform bill passes, he says. So he paints himself into a corner to the distress of the remaining reformist Tories. There had been Canningites and Pittites, of course, Huskinsonites, who were reformist Tories. But he drives his party right into a corner, doesn't he, at this point?
Yes, when he says the beginning of reform is the beginning of revolution, that is an explicit remark which leaves no doubt at all, and leaves more or less the rest of Parliament, except for a very few what were called ultra-Tories, thinking, hey, wait a minute, wouldn't the beginning of reform actually put off the beginning of revolution? And unless we reform, we will have revolution, as they're having over the Channel. So we've got to reform to put that off. And so you get these opposing forces between stability and experiment, you know. And these, I think, are two strong feelings in the human breast. I mean, nobody is entirely for stability. And nobody is entirely for experiment, and it's balancing the scales. But I think in the end, Wellington's extraordinarily outspoken condemnation of any reform in view of the situation, which I've described to you, went, oddly enough, a little way towards helping the reformers. If he'd accommodated at all, it might have been more difficult. Mm-hmm. Did you think that?
I do. It's quite interesting, so difficult for us now to think how you could have defended this extraordinary arrangement. But people did. There's the sort of thin end of the wedge argument that the Duke uses then, that any change will be unstoppable and where will it end? Then there is the good old city. James Rothschild writes from Paris to Nathan in London, "The latest French Revolution has caused stocks to fall by 30%. Time for England to put a stop to this infamous liberal spirit." Now, interestingly, the Rothschilds took a different view as time went on. They became more pragmatic. But at the beginning, the instinct is to say, all this will end in tears and the stocks will go down, so stop it.
In the meantime, the Whigs, Lord Grey said languidly to Lord Durham, who was his son-in-law, who was known as Radical Jack as opposed to Honest Jack, who was a fiery character, Radical Jack Lambton, Lord Durham, "Lambton, could you look after this reform bill?" And he did it, did it on the steps of the House of Lords. And so a committee of four, very secret, set up to design the reform bill. And in order to keep it really secret, they didn't allow it to any clerks, because clerks, you know, indiscreet, might be hacked, whatever the contemporary version of hacked was. And he gave it to his daughters to do all the copying. And they are among the unsung secretaries, like rather like Churchill's secretaries in the war, you know, who really knew all the secrets and were vital. And so Lord John Russell, who's part of this committee, who will go on in later years to be Lord Russell and Prime Minister, he is able to get up on his feet on the 1st of March, 1831, and produce a bill which nobody knows what it's going to be. This is in the House of Commons. He is the younger son of a Duke and in the House of Commons. And people are absolutely staggered. People go pale. People sort of peel, leant forward and put his head in his hands because they were completely unprepared. And that explains why it's an extraordinary drama, really, from the beginning, from that moment onwards. The drama starts.
And my goodness, it is a parliamentary drama. As you say, that wonderful ambush, they produce the bill. The Tories are assuming that they'll produce either some really watered-down bill or won't do anything. Wellington thinks they won't do anything. But actually, they produce, in the terms of the day, quite an advanced bill. I mean, quite a wide property franchise. We have to remember in all this that all this battle is about increasing the electorate by from sort of 400-ish thousand to 600-ish thousand. So it's not, we're a long way off popular franchise, but it's the symbolic thing of beginning the process. In that sense, the Duke of Wellington is quite right, that if things begin, they will go on.
But also, he's quite wrong, because when you get to the end of the story, there isn't revolution. No. Reform has, so he's both right and wrong. But I would maintain very strongly that this was a tremendously exciting moment. And the statistics the figures really mean very little, although that seems such a small amount out of a population of 16 million. Actually, for the first time, some account is paid, not for a lot of people with property managing everything, but to what the people, not the mob, but what the people actually want. And that's why I think it's known as the Great Reform Bill, even though reform bills lay ahead. But going back, of course, to the drama at the time, I had a wonderful time reading the parliamentary debates because, first of all, I went and read them in their huge volumes in the Institute of Historical Research, where you could just take them off the shelf and read them. And it's that valuable thing of being able to look at the debate before and 3 days on, you know, just really be at home. And then I go home and I write my book and I read them all over again online. You know, you can get all these debates online. I give the reference in my book. And you may think this is not going to be a thriller, but actually, the parliamentary debates, the language is so wonderful. It's oratory, it's still oratory, and it's high-flown, and it's long, possibly more fun to read in a comfortable chair online than actually listen to until the early hours of the morning. But it's a thrilling episode in our history.
Antonia gives the most wonderful impression in this book of how the old unreformed House of Commons, unreformed though it was, and unreformed in the building too. She gives a wonderful feel of how stuffy and hot and smelly, with people lying over the gaps in the ceiling to look down to see what's happening. Debates that go on and on through the night. And this pressure cooker, almost literally like a pressure cooker, is representing in a strange way the turmoil that's going on in the country, with huge meetings in Birmingham and in Manchester, hundreds of thousands of people, with the rioting in Bristol, in which many people are killed, when the first bill is defeated in the House of Lords. And yet somehow this unreformed assembly does focus, doesn't it, the tensions in the country in an extraordinary way.
I think you're quite right that the riots are extraordinarily important. I mean, if we focus on Bristol, the Speaker of the House of Commons, Sir Charles Wetherill, who is known to be anti-reform, comes bowling down, and he's met already by riots, including women. Women, of course, there are no women MPs, and no idea of giving women votes. It doesn't mean women don't exist. And optimistically, the mob said that all the women in the crowds were loose women. I don't know how on earth they knew. They were only women, loose women, in that they were women on the loose. They were actually intelligent, active, energetic women. Anyway, 3 days of rioting, which end with the Speaker. Imagine it happened to John Bercow. What a horrifying thought. Being chased over the roofs of Bristol from the Mansion House in disguise, like a sort of Mozartian character in an opera. And inside, they sack the Mansion House. They eat all the food. Most of them are starving, so it's rather nice. Turtle soup, well, nice work if you can get it. Then there's fires, and some of them get so drunk, the rioters, they die in the fire. So it's an extraordinary, this is Bristol, you know.
This is my old constituency, incidentally. and they did indeed chase the bishop, I think. And the bishop, because of course the Church of England always perhaps represents the sort of general acceptable opinion of the day. And the acceptable opinion of the day in the House of Lords then was mostly reactionary. So the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Bishop of Bristol and the Bishop of Exeter led the charge, rather, in the Lords. A particularly tragic figure, I think, in the Bristol story, Captain Brereton of the of the cavalry, of the 14th Dragoons, who refused to let his soldiers fire on the rioting mob. And then when the government lost control of the city, and perhaps as many as 400 people were killed, he then shot himself for grief.
It's even the details, even sadder than that. The reason he didn't want his men to fire. These were all his men's, they were local, their brothers, you know, their fathers, possibly their wives and sisters. And he's then had up afterwards for not firing and court-martialed, and he shoots himself between the court-martial and the sentence. And there is a play called The Recruiting Officer. It's not actually, it doesn't take place in Bristol, somewhere in the north. But that shows you how these recruiting officers, how these forces really belong to the neighborhoods. And yes. So one understands they didn't want to actually just fire. And I was thinking about it in the recent riots, which actually, in August 2011, for example, they were taking place while I was writing about these riots. And it is a very difficult thing, the relationship between the law keepers and the rioters, you know. I mean, there will always be some rioters who, if not in 1831, in 2011, want a new television set. But there will be other rioters who genuinely want reform. Mm-hmm. And it's a difficult one.
Yeah. But it shows how, looking back now, we think, but you won't think this when you've read Antonia's book, that all this happened smoothly in a good English, calm way, and reform came along. You can see why, on the one hand, there were revolutionaries thinking their time had come, and there were many tricolours were being produced everywhere, and the real radicals talking about the great French Revolution, and the 1830 French Revolution had spread a bit in Europe, to some of the German cities, to Switzerland, to Belgium and the Netherlands. So, on the one hand, the revolutionary is saying our time has come, and on the other hand, the reactionary is saying, well, perhaps they're saying the very self-same thing, and it was dangerous. It wasn't inevitable that there was a happy outcome.
Yes, and I think we should touch on the role of the monarchy, King William yes. IV, and Queen Adelaide, his wife, because the exact role of a constitutional monarch had not been worked out in the way we know it today, and in a kind of way, how it was known in the 20th century. The long reign of Queen Victoria, who succeeds King William IV, being his niece in 1837, the long reign led to a lot of things being sorted out. But King William IV had, in theory, a lot of power. For one thing, he could create lords. If you want a measure to pass the House of Lords, one easy way is to create a lot of new lords, and he had that power. Now, William IV was, in my opinion, a good man, a decent man. He was untrained, except for the Navy. But he had a wife called Adelaide, who was 30 years younger, who he'd been told to marry in order to produce an heir. And having lived with Mrs. Jordan, the actress, with 12 illegitimate children, they desperately wanted a legitimate child. And she was a German princess, and she'd been brought up in Europe, where the tradition of horror about revolution was the story of Marie Antoinette. And they were all cousins, who was originally Austrian, of course. But she got her head chopped off because of revolution. So Adelaide was really strongly, not so much against revolution, as terrified by it. This made her a Tory. In a way, again, we would not expect the consort of the monarch to have strong political views, or whatever that we may think that be, we would be confident that he or she would not express them rightly. But Queen Adelaide was always plotting. Mm. And she wasn't an insignificant figure for one reason. I was allowed to go and read her diary, which is in the Royal Archives at Windsor. And in her diary, it's quite clear that she had a happy conjugal life. And once or twice, she's only in her 30s, she's given birth to two children, two different times, both of whom have unfortunately died at 3 months or 8 months, you know, as happened. But she does, from time to time, expect to have another child. This child would, first of all, have dispossessed little Princess Victoria, would have succeeded to the throne first, and secondly, would have made Queen Adelaide regent, which was a powerful position. So Queen Adelaide's influence, which became increasingly anti-reform, is not to be ignored. Furthermore, she aroused the attention of the press. Now, in case you think our royal family suffer from the press, forget it. The press are pussycats today compared to that press. I mean, it was just appalling. Some of the cartoons, Queen Adelaide being German is regularly referred to as a German bee, and she's mocked for having a German accent, which, as she was brought up in Germany, seems extremely unfair.
And she's referred to as sauerkraut, you know.
Yes, and etc. And she's accused of having a scandalous relationship with her Lord Chamberlain, who was more her age, very handsome man. I give a photograph of him. He was called Lord Howe. And when she was thought to be pregnant, in fact, she lost the child, I think it was it Wicked Sidney Smith, the wit? Somebody said, Howe, with an E, miraculous.
So this was, she was crucial, and the king was crucial. When the lords had turned out the first version of the bill, defeated it, then the two ways round, really, were to persuade the Tories, either to drop the bill, or persuade the Tories, some Tories, to support it, which was, with Wellington leading them as he was, impossible, or to create peers. And she had influence at that point. But in the end, slightly under duress, the king does agree, oh, well, I will create the extra peers if necessary, and the threat of that makes the Tories stand back.
Yes, but when he said he would, if absolutely necessary, create peers, rather sulkily, but he then put a lot of caveats. He yes. said, we mustn't enlarge the aristocracy, so they must be nice aristocratic people would be peers. Best of all would be those eldest sons I mentioned who were going to get into the Lords one day, so that wouldn't enlarge the aristocracy, like Lord Althorp or, for instance, Lord Blandford, heir to the Duke of Marlborough, who extraordinarily, for an ultra-Tory, was in favour of reform because, wait for it, he thought it would keep the Catholics out of Parliament. I mean, does it get complicated? But that kind of person, he thought, would be a good peer. And he also thought it would be a frankly good idea if other people who made peers should be what was called a baroner. That is to say, they were known not to be able to have children. For one reason or another, though I think the fact somebody hadn't had children when they were 60 was no proof they might not have them after that. But there were some sort of ridiculous rhymes and stories of the maid who asked for a staff position and said, my lord, I can do this, I can do that, and besides, I'm a baroner, meaning she wasn't going to have inconvenient children. Honest Jack Althorp said that this is exactly the kind of person which were wanted for the new lords, baroners, play on baron, etc. But none of that in the end, and it's so delicate. It's a war of nerves, actually. That's what the days of May 1832 were, a war of nerves. And I begged my publisher, and they agreed to publish my book in May, because it was published last month, because having lived through the days of May, and they are very, very tense. There are people massing and arming in the provinces. There are messages about future riots and wars and disruption. And then the Lords refusing, the King hanging fire. And finally, he says, all right. And finally, the ultra-Tory peers say, rather than be enlarged, which we don't want, all right, we will stay away. And that is when Lord Walgrave and Lord Longford stayed away. But I have to say, William, I don't know about Lord Walgrave, but Lord Longford went to the Derby, so it wasn't all that bad.
I have absolutely no doubt that Lord Walgrave was at the Derby as well. but Lord Willoughby de Brooke and Lord Dartmouth, they stuck to their guns. Anyway, yes. The drama of those days, because with consummate skill and nerve, Grey resigns and says, challenges Wellington effectively to try and form another government. And Wellington, being an honourable duty soldier, says, well, I'll try. It doesn't sort of get the whole story. But slowly the penny drops that if he comes back into a minority government and drops the reform bill, there will be real danger in the streets. And Antonio's been criticised only by The Guardian. for not writing about aristocrats and parliamentarians and not about what was going on in the streets. I can only say that that reviewer cannot have read the book, because she gives a wonderful picture of the drama of the great movements and the importance of the moderate, decent people, as we would say, like Thomas Attwood, who kept the very big numbers of people in these great rallies non-violent. And it wasn't easy to do. And that really is a tribute, I think, to a sort of an Englishness, a sense of solidarity in the country that there certainly hadn't been in France.
Yes, and de Tocqueville, who paid a visit to England about this time, commented that the English aristocracy, never mind William IV, was much more porous. There was no sense of being, or the upper class, of being absolutely separate. People could move in, which means people could also move out. And it was absolutely true that it was significant that Birmingham was one of the great reforming places where Attwood lived. He was near Birmingham, and where the great meetings were. And every time they sang these wonderful songs, they took care that the songs contained lines, "We come not with swords," and Birmingham was a great place for making swords, incidentally, manufacturing. "We come not with swords, but with our courage, with our wits, with our feelings. We're not going violent." But, of course, it wasn't quite so simple, because beneath all of that was, during this war of nerves, beneath all of that, the subtext was quite clear. If you don't give us nice, non-violent, what we might call middle-class people, it's always difficult with class delineations, another age, if you don't give us our perfectly reasonable, non-violent demands, we do happen to know some very violent people down the road. And we cannot possibly answer for these rather violent people down the road. I think I saw them rehearsing the charges with rough sides and all sorts of nasty things. We don't believe in that at all. Oh, dear. I mean, we just can't think of anything worse. But I thought I'd just mention again that we are non-violent. All we need is votes in Parliament. And that's really how it went. And, of course, that suited the Whigs in government. They were able to say, well, look, we're absolutely doing our best, and we're in very good relations with the nice people in Birmingham, Manchester, particularly Birmingham, incidentally, Birmingham, because there were lots of small manufacturing industries where the bosses and the men were closer. Manchester was grander. But anyway, they said, you know, they are very keen to join with us, and one has to use a word, that there was a kind of coalition, actually. Wasn't there, William?
It was, the general was, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't just Whig aristocrats pushing it through. They were also joining with people like Attwood and people all around the country. Just the people begin to be distinguished from the mob. People now refer to the people, and they don't necessarily mean the mob.
I want to end before throwing it out to some questions with a couple of comments. First on Lord Blandford, about whom Antonia has spoken, who was a radical ultra-Tory who was in favour of reform in order to keep the Catholics down. Now, he is actually, in a way, he's the future, because it's bad luck for the progressives, but the people are not always progressive. It was a progressive cause to widen the franchise, but the great Tory leader Lord Salisbury, and before him Disraeli, realised that the instincts of the widened franchise weren't necessarily on the left at all. So in a funny way, Lord Blandford has something to say to the modern people, that there are people who have votes and who read great newspapers like the Daily Mail and are not necessarily on the left.
The Daily Mail's not on the left.
I'm sorry.
Oh, well, I'm going to leave at once.
So I think Blandford is in a curious way, a sign of the future, that of course the Whigs gained for a bit and did win the next elections, but in the long term, the growth of a middle-class property-owning vote kept the Tories in power for most of the 20th century. The other interesting thing, which perhaps we just end with, a comment, Antonia, on this, is Halévy, the great French Frenchman who wrote a very good history of England. He says, and I think it's true, if you were a proper Marxist analyst and you looked at all the countries of Europe in 1820 as to which one would blow up and have a real revolution, surely you would have said England, all its industrialization, its disenfranchised working class and so on. But it wasn't. And it was something to do with the skill of people like Macaulay saying reform to preserve, or Grey leading the great property owners to say we've got to share the wealth. Who saved that, I think? Do you think that's fair?
Yes, no, I think that's absolutely fair. I mean, it's difficult to study this story without feeling proud to be English, actually, that we avoided it, you know, and we'll avoid it again in 1848, you know. So we'll allow ourselves a little national pride because of the ability of people to move together. Mm. And that's how it was secured.
And this book gives you the most wonderful account of an absolutely critical and wonderfully dramatic episode in that story.
Can I just say one last thing? My motto in history was something, in writing it, I read from the great historian F.W. Maitland. We must always remember that what now lies in the past once lay in the future. And if you think about it, that's the whole art of writing history. And I have tried to write this book as though we don't know that the Reform Bill will go through, because they didn't know. Anyway, thank you, Will.
Which makes it tremendously exciting as a story.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.